Chapter 17.
"I'm sorry you're not coming back with us, Martin," said Norton as they approached Lock 1 West, "but I'm sure you're doing the right thing, and we all respect you for it."
"Thanks," said Gibson sincerely. "I'd like to have made the return trip with you all. Still, there'll be plenty of chances later. Whatever happens, I'm not going to be on Mars all my life." He chuckled. "I guess you never thought you'd be swapping passengers in this way."
"I certainly didn't. It's going to be a bit embarrassing in some respects. I'll feel like the captain of the ship who had to carry Napoleon to Elba. How's the chief taking it?"
"I've not spoken to him since the recall came through, though I'll be seeing him tomorrow before he goes up to Deimos. But Whittaker says he seems confident enough and doesn't appear to be worrying in the slightest."
"What do you think's going to happen?"
"On the official level, he's bound to be reprimanded for misappropriation of funds, equipment, personnel. Oh, enough things to land him in jail for the rest of his life. But as half the executives and all the scientists on Mars are involved, what can Earth do about it? It's really a very amusing situation. The CE is a public hero on two worlds, and the Interplanetary Development Board will have to handle him with kid gloves. I think the verdict will be, 'You shouldn't have done it, but we're rather glad you did.'"
"And then they'll let him come back to Mars?"
"They're bound to. No one else can do his job."
"Someone will have to one day."
"True enough. But it would be madness to waste Hadfield when he's still got years of work in him. And heaven help anyone who was sent here to replace him."
"It certainly is a peculiar position. I think a lot's been going on that we don't know about. Why did Earth turn down Project Dawn when it was first suggested?"
"I've been wondering about that, and intend to get to the bottom of it some day. Meanwhile, my theory is this. I think a lot of people on Earth don't want Mars to become too powerful, still less completely independent. Not for any sinister reason, mark you, but simply because they don't like the idea. It's too wounding to their pride. They want the Earth to remain the center of the universe."
"You know," said Norton, "it's funny how you talk about Earth, as if it was some combination of miser and bully, preventing all progress here. After all, it's hardly fair. What you're actually grumbling at are the administrators in the Interplanetary Development Board and all its allied organizations, and they're really trying to do their best. Don't forget that everything you've got here is due to the enterprise and initiative of Earth. I'm afraid you colonists," he gave a wry grin as he spoke, "take a very self-centered view of things. I can see both sides of the question. When I'm here, I get your point of view and can sympathize with it. But in 3 months' time, I'll be on the other side, and will probably think you're a lot of grumbling, ungrateful nuisances here on Mars." Gibson laughed, not altogether comfortably. There was a good deal of truth in what Norton had said. The sheer difficulty and expense of interplanetary travel, and the time it took to get from world to world, made inevitable some lack of understanding, even intolerance, between Earth and Mars. He hoped that as the speed of transport increased, these psychological barriers would be broken down, and the two planets would come closer together in spirit as well as in time. They had now reached the lock and were waiting for the transport to take Norton out to the airstrip. The rest of the crew had already said goodbye and were now on their way up to Deimos. Only Jimmy had received special dispensation to fly up with Hadfield and Irene when they left tomorrow. Jimmy had certainly changed his status, thought Gibson with some amusement, since the Ares had left Earth. He wondered just how much work Norton was going to get out of him on the homeward voyage.
"Well, John, I hope you have a good trip back," said Gibson, holding out his hand as the airlock door opened.
"When will I be seeing you again?"
"In about 18 months. I've got a trip to Venus to put in first. When I get back here, I expect to find quite a difference. Airweed and Martians everywhere."
"I don't promise much in that time," laughed Gibson, "but we'll do our best not to disappoint you." They shook hands, and Norton was gone. Gibson found it impossible not to feel a twinge of envy as he thought of all the things to which the other was returning, all the unconsidered beauties of Earth which he had once taken for granted, and now might not see again for many years. He still had two farewells to make, and they would be the most difficult of all. his last meeting with Hadfield would require considerable delicacy and tact. Norden's analogy, he thought, had been a good one. It would be rather like an interview with a dethroned monarch about to sail into exile. In actual fact, it proved to be like nothing of the sort. Hadfield was still master of the situation, and seemed quite unperturbed by his future. When Gibson entered, he had just finished sorting out his papers. The room looked bare and bleak, and three waste paper baskets were piled high with discarded forms and memoranda. Whittaker, as acting chief executive, will be moving in tomorrow. "I've run through your note on the Martians and the airweed," said Hadfield, exploring the deeper recesses of his desk. "It's a very interesting idea, but no one can tell me whether it will work or not. The position's extremely complicated, and we haven't enough information. It really comes down to this. Would we get a better return for our efforts if we teach Martians to plant airweed, or if we do the job ourselves? Anyway, we'll set up a small research group to look into the idea, though there's not much we can do until we've got some more Martians. I've asked Dr. Peterson to handle the scientific side, and I'd like you to deal with the administrative problems as they arise, leaving any major decisions to Whittaker, of course. Peterson's a very sound fellow, but he lacks imagination. Between the two of you, we should get the right balance." "I'll be very glad to do all I can," said Gibson, quite pleased with the prospect, though wondering a little nervously how he could cope with his increasing responsibilities. However, the fact that the chief had given him the job was encouraging. It meant that Hadfield, at any rate, was sure that he could handle it. As they discussed administrative details, it became clear to Gibson that Hadfield did not expect to be away from Mars for more than a year. He even seemed to be looking forward to his trip to Earth, regarding it almost in the light of an overdue holiday. Gibson hoped that this optimism would be justified by the outcome. Towards the end of their interview, the conversation turned inevitably to Irene and Jimmy. The long voyage back to Earth would provide Hadfield with all the opportunities he needed to study his prospective son-in-law, and Gibson hoped that Jimmy would be on his best behavior. It was obvious that Hadfield was contemplating this aspect of the trip with quiet amusement. As he remarked to Gibson, if Irene and Jimmy could put up with each other in such close quarters for 3 months, their marriage was bound to be a success. If they couldn't, then the sooner they found out, the better. As he left Hadfield's office, Gibson hoped that he had made his own sympathy clear. The CE knew that he had all Mars behind him, and Gibson would do his best to gain him the support of Earth as well. He looked back at the unobtrusive lettering on the door. There would be no need to change that, whatever happened, since the words designated the position and not the man. For 12 months or so, Whittaker would be working behind that door, the democratic ruler of Mars and the, within reasonable limits, conscientious servant of Earth. Whoever came and went, the lettering on the door would remain. That was another part of Hadfield's ideas, the tradition that the post was more important than the man. He had not, Gibson thought, given it a very good start, for anonymity was scarcely one of Hadfield's personal characteristics. The last rocket to Deimos left 3 hours later with Hadfield, Irene, and Jimmy aboard. Irene had come round to the Grand Martian Hotel to help Jimmy pack and to say goodbye to Gibson. She was bubbling over with excitement and so radiant with happiness that it was a pleasure simply to sit and watch her. Both her dreams had come true at once. She was going back to Earth, and she was going with Jimmy. Gibson hoped that neither experience would disappoint her. He did not believe it would. Jimmy's packing was complicated by the number of souvenirs he had gathered on Mars, chiefly plant and mineral specimens collected on various trips outside the dome. All these had to be carefully weighed, and some heart-rending decisions were involved when it was discovered that he had exceeded his personal allowance by 2 kilograms. But finally the last suitcase was packed and on its way to the airport. "Now don't forget," said Gibson, "to contact Mrs. Goldstein as soon as you arrive. She'll be expecting to hear from you." "I won't," Jimmy replied. "It's good of you to take all this trouble. We really do appreciate everything you've done, don't we, Irene?" "Yes," she answered, "we certainly do. I don't know how we'd have got on without you."
Gibson smiled a little wistfully.
"Somehow," he said, "I think you'd still have managed in one way or another. But I'm glad everything's turned out so well for you, and I'm sure you're going to be very happy. And I hope it won't be too long before you're both back on Mars."
As he gripped Jimmy's hand in farewell, Gibson felt once again that almost overwhelming desire to reveal his identity and, whatever the consequences, to greet Jimmy as his son. But if he did so, he knew now, the dominant motive would be pure egotism. It would be an act of possessiveness, of inexcusable self-assertion, and it would undo all the good he had wrought in these past months. Yet as he dropped Jimmy's hand, he glimpsed something in the other's expression that he had never seen before. It could have been the dawn of the first puzzled surmise, the birth of the still half-conscious thought that might grow at last to fully fledged understanding and recognition. Gibson hoped it was so. It would make his task easier when the time came. He watched them go hand in hand down the narrow street, oblivious to all around them, their thoughts even now winging outwards into space. Already they had forgotten him, but later they would remember. It was just before dawn when Gibson left the main airlock and walked away from the still sleeping city. Phobos had set an hour ago. The only light was that of the stars and Deimos, now high in the west. He looked at his watch. 10 minutes to go, if there had been no hitch. "Come on, Squeak," he said. "Let's take a nice, brisk walk to keep warm." Though the temperature around them was at least 50 below, Squeak did not seem unduly worried. However, Gibson thought it best to keep his pet on the move. He was, of course, perfectly comfortable himself, as he was wearing his full protective clothing. How these plants had grown in the past few weeks! They were now taller than a man, and though some of this increase might be normal, Gibson was sure that much of it was due to Phobos. Project Dawn was already leaving its mark on the planet. Even the North Polar Cap, which should now be approaching its midwinter maximum, had halted in its advance over the opposite hemisphere, and the remnants of the Southern Cap had vanished completely. They came to a stop about a kilometer from the city, far enough away for its lights not to hinder observation. Gibson glanced again at his watch. Less than a minute left. He knew what his friends were feeling now. He stared at the tiny, barely visible gibbous disk of Deimos and waited. Quite suddenly, Deimos became conspicuously brighter. A moment later, it seemed to split into two fragments as a tiny, incredibly bright star detached itself from its edge and began to creep slowly westwards. Even across these thousands of kilometers of space, the glare of the atomic rockets was so dazzling that it almost hurt the eye. He did not doubt that they were watching him. Up there in the Aries, they would be at the observation windows, looking down upon the great crescent world which they were leaving now, as a lifetime ago, it seemed, he had bade farewell to Earth. What was Hadfield thinking now? Was he wondering if he would ever see Mars again? Gibson no longer had any real doubts on this score. Whatever battles Hadfield might have to face, he would win through as he had done in the past. He was returning to Earth in triumph, not in disgrace. That dazzling blue-white star was several degrees from Deimos now, falling behind as it lost speed to drop sunwards and earthwards. The rim of the sun came up over the eastern horizon. All around him, the tall green plants were stirring in their sleep, a sleep already interrupted once by the meteoric passage of Phobos across the sky. Gibson looked once more at the two stars descending in the west and raised his hand in a silent farewell.
"Come along, Squeak," he said. "Time to get back. I've got work to do."
He tweaked the little Martian's ears with his gloved fingers.
"And that goes for you, too," he added. "Though you don't know it yet, we've both got a pretty big job ahead of us."
They walked together towards the great domes,
now glistening faintly in the first morning light. It would be strange in Port Lowell, now that Hadfield had gone, and another man was sitting behind the door marked Chief Executive. Gibson suddenly paused. For a fleeting moment, it seemed, he saw into the future, 15 or 20 years ahead. Who would be chief then, when Project Dawn was entering its middle phase and its end could already be foreseen? The question and the answer came almost simultaneously. For the first time, Gibson knew what lay at the end of the road on which he had now set his feet. One day, perhaps, it would be his duty and his privilege to take over the work which Hadfield had begun. It might have been sheer self-deception, or it might have been the first consciousness of his own still hidden powers, but whichever it was, he meant to know. With a new briskness in his step, Martin Gibson, writer, late of Earth, resumed his walk towards the city. His shadow merged with Squeak's as the little Martian hopped beside him, while overhead the last hues of night drained from the sky, and all around the tall, flowerless plants were unfolding to face the sun. This has been an Audible Frontiers production of The Sands of Mars, written by Arthur C. Clarke, narrated by Traber Burns, producer Mike Charzik. Copyright 1952-1967 by Arthur C. Clarke. Production copyright 2012 by Audible, Inc.